Good morning, everybody. We're going to start directly on the program. And I have a pleasure to introduce to you all State Secretary to the Minister of Local Government and Modernization here in Norway, Mr. Paul Chaffee, please.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the kind invitation. And excuse me for keeping you waiting a few minutes. We've had a pretty unusual political situation in Norway this weekend. The conclusion is, at least so far, that the government stays, so that there won't be a lot of media attention internationally. But we were very close to having a government crisis this weekend, because we have a minority government, and one of the partners in parliament that the government relies on support called an extraordinary congress to decide which side of the political dividing line, a quite small Christian Democrat party in the middle, had a discussion on whether to go from the centre-right to the centre-left, which would have meant a change of government. But by, what was it, 198 to 90 delegates, they decided to negotiate, instead go the opposite way and negotiate whether they are going to be part of the present government. So that will be exciting to be part of in time to come. Now we might have four parties in government who disagree on certain things. So that will be interesting. But the good thing, I've been part of the government apparatus as a politician now for 5 years. We had a change of government in 2013. Been in the same ministry all the whole time. We created a new ministry for public administration, local government, and modernization. So the digital portfolio in the public sector is part of the work we are doing, and therefore it's. And we're living in interesting times, I must say. So, and you're an example also on the technological front. So, thanks a lot for the invitation to open this workshop. Looking at your agenda for the next 2 days, it looks very interesting. And to be honest, if my time had allowed it, I would have loved to be here longer to follow all of your discussions. The workshop has the aim to help governments identify untapped opportunities to use digital technology in science and in the innovation processes, and you also aim to point to where changes in digital technology require changes in the design of mainstream policy approaches. And of course that is one of the hard parts that we are responsible for, not only applying technology but getting out the effects and the dividends we can, both for citizens, for businesses, and for government itself. There are a lot of opportunities out there. I like to think of myself as a technology optimist, but of course there are also a lot of challenges, and we need the expert view on where to focus and what approaches to take. We are living in a world of big changes these days, and technology is certainly a big part of that picture. Before my present job, I was the CEO of a Norwegian Business Association for knowledge and technology-based enterprises for some years. And also there, of course, the discussions on what are the future triggers, what trends should we follow, where should we, as top level management, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, be especially concerned and especially interested in following and in some cases regulate what we should do to get the best use out of it. Your agenda here focuses on blockchain and AI in science, on using digital technology to draw on the collective intelligence of science and innovation communities, on how virtual reality and AI might facilitate education in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, novel means of accelerating technology diffusion, and digital technology for open science. Of course, all these are important factors that will affect how our society will develop in the future, affect citizens, governments, and the private sector. And for a politician like me, of course, it's a big and great interest in seeing how these things work together, where we should do something to make an impact, and in some cases perhaps get out of the way, because we will create problems if we try to regulate in areas where that aren't ready for regulation. I would briefly also comment on where Norway stands in a couple of the areas you raise in your agenda. Access to data is essential to AI. Norway has worked systematically over several years to make public sector data available. During 2017 and 2018, we have developed strategies for research data, transportation data, cultural data, and geo data. And we have also created digital access to the central government's accounts. We will now look into new sectors when it comes to opening even more data, and we intend to look at relevant regulations in order to make it easier to open up public sector data for sharing in a responsible manner. We do not have a document we call a strategy on AI, but the government has committed itself to develop a set of guidelines and ethical principles for the use of AI. And the goal is to make sure that our baseline is to use AI in a responsible and sustainable way. The goal is, of course, also to uphold the trust that the Norwegian population has in government and in our democratic processes. There are AI labs set up at a number of Norwegian universities, amongst them the Norwegian Open AI Lab at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, NTNU, and CARE, Center for Artificial Intelligence at the University of Agder. Norway has a series of Centers for Research-Based Innovation, SFIs. A couple of these include AI specifically as part of their multidisciplinary research. And being a full member of Horizon 2020, Norwegian researchers and companies are active in the AI calls. There are several strong research groups within big data, IoT, and machine learning that have been successful. The Norwegian Research Council's academic and thematic priorities for the ICT portfolio are set through its strategic scheme, ICT Plus. AI is included in the strategic focus area called Ubiquitous Data and Services. In December 2017, a total of 200 million Norwegian kroner was awarded to 13 ICT projects within a call entitled Data and Services Everywhere. 9 of the 13 projects use methods and techniques associated with AI. And let me also mention that the Norwegian public sector is already experimenting with AI. The Norwegian Tax Administration and the Norwegian Labour and Welfare Administration are exploring how AI can make their services more available and easy to use. And several municipalities and some government agencies are utilising probably more simple AI for customer contacts or chat bots that I believe will also be an interesting thing to follow and will probably become more and more advanced as time passes. I will also like to mention high-performance computing and that Norway decided to participate in the R&D part of the Euro-HPC joint undertaking for the remaining period of Horizon 2020. With the increasing amounts of data we already see, and will see even more in the future, processing capacity will be a crucial infrastructure for every country. You have a lot of interesting discussions in front of you during the next 2 days. I won't myself, as I said, be able to be here and follow it, but I'm sure Morten Eggens and other prominent people from the Norwegian community in these areas will be able to tell us what we should be especially concerned with. Our experience is too that every time there's a discussion on priorities in research budgets and so on, we certainly hear from the communities that are involved what we should be doing and what we should be prioritizing when it comes to our own budgets. And in fact, we're in the middle of everything with discussions on which side we should have the government. Of course, we have a budget that's going to go through Parliament, a new long-term plan for research and education that's going to be passed in Parliament together with the budget. So we certainly live in interesting times, and you're a great part of that. Thank you very much.
Well, it's time for me to wish you all welcome. Welcome to Norway. Welcome to Oslo. Welcome to Oslo Met. My name is Morten Eggens. I'm the Vice Rector at this university, Oslo Metropolitan University, Oslo Met. We have 22,000 students, and I cannot see any of the professions that and jobs we are educating these students to and for. I won't be turned upside down in one way or another by technology in the next few years. Actually, I said in the next few years, this is happening quite fast. It is, for me, very important to understand how we can start the transformation early in order to be able to meet the future in the best possible way. Norway is a very digitized society. I haven't used cash for the last 5 years, I believe. Only when I leave the country. So I do believe it's a. I know we're starting the transformation away from cards, and it's all on my mobile phone. It seems so small, all those little details, but it's some. It changes thoroughly how this the fabric of the society. And this trend has been accelerating over the last years, as you know. I can add that I'm a scientist in AI. I've been working in AI since 1988. Now being a vice rector, I don't have time to do the thing that I really liked. And now I do something else I really like, but it's very, very different. But I can use my combined knowledge here to put a focus on how AI is transforming our societies. Welcome to this workshop, How New Technologies Transform Science and Science Policies, very important. Thanks to OECD and for the fantastic work they have done to put together the program. It's been a wonderful to work with Alistair and the rest in OECD. Thank you so much. And welcome then to two very hectic days. This is a series of dialogues. You will not be able to relax and sit back and just... If you read the program, which you should have done, it's very clearly that you are supposed to work. By that, I would like to welcome the head of the Division for Science and Technology Policy in OECD, Mr. Dominic Gillek, please.
Thank you, Morten. So we are going to start work soon. Before that, you have another 2 minutes to relax during my speech. So, State Secretary Chaffee, ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure and an honor to welcome you at this Oslo Met OECD workshop on digital technology for science and innovation, emerging topics for policy assessment. In fact, the OECD at the moment is conducting a broad project that we call Going Digital, which is about all the transformation that digitalization is bringing to, well, you name it, taxes, trade, jobs, well, everything, government, and so on. It's a fascinating exercise. We are discovering how broad and deep the transformation is. But we see that there is an area that is making less noise than others in the policy arena. It is science and innovation policy. There are good reasons for that. If you ask citizens what is important to them, yes, taxes, trade, jobs, that's important. Science and innovation, I did that when I was at school. Okay. So there are good reasons in democracies for that, but it's not really valid reasons when you think from a policy perspective. First, because of course these new technologies were born out of the science and innovation area. If you think of the autonomous car that is now being pioneered by many companies and so on, it was 12 years ago a DARPA challenge that more or less pushed it forward. If you think of all the modern version of neural network that is transforming the life of all users of this sort of thing, meaning everybody, it was when 2012, when there was this convolutional neural network, blah, blah, blah. So this is science. This is science. This is innovation. So this area pioneered this technology, but not only that, and that's where our workshop has a role, I believe. This area is the most advanced user of these technologies. So there are many lessons that we are learning with these technologies, not only in terms of how to use them, but in policy terms, that could benefit other areas as well. Probably the link between astrophysics and taxes is, well, although there might be linkages, but it's not straightforward. But still, there might be generic lessons. So that will be important that in our discussions, not only we talk of what matters for our area, but also how it could sort of scale to the rest of government, to the rest of society, and that would reinforce the legitimacy of our communities in the public discussion. One aspect that I had in mind notably, it's about democracy. What people have seen of new technologies contributing to democracy to date has been essentially fake news. There is more that this technology can do to democracy, and more useful, more positive, hopefully. They can also bring back people to the democratic table. There are advanced experiments that are conducted in our area regarding how to design the science agenda and so on. But that's one example. There are others also that we will discuss over the coming 2 days that really could help raise the status of our own discussions in the more global discussions on new technologies. So before I give the floor to Alistair, who wants to say? No, everybody knows Alistair, of course, now. I want to thank, of course, Morten Irgens, who was the person, together with Alistair, who did this event possible, and I'm sure the whole his impressive network of contacts to be mobilized here. Actually, human capital is the scarcest resource in this field. I mean, there is so huge demand for people there to work, to talk, and so on, that it's really great that we could mobilize you over 2 days. That's a very precious resource, and want to thank you all for that. I also want to thank Julie Bie. Sorry, my pronunciation of Norwegian is approximative. But thank you anyway. And Kjersti Sjatil and all your team for having ensured the successful logistics of the event, the fact that we are here demonstrates that you were successful. Want to inform you that this event will be video recorded. It will be diffused through the OECD network. Okay, it's not Facebook, but still, I mean, for the community, for the people that we are targeting, we might have more impact than if we were to put in, and less censorship, probably, than if we were to put it in on Facebook. And your interventions will also be reflected in the proceedings and in a later OECD work that will come in time, notably report, a synthesis report that Alistair is preparing on the science and innovation policies in front of digitalization. So, with no further delay, we move to session one. That is a sort of what inspirational moment, I guess, that Bruce Damer. Bruce will share with us his thought on this topic. That is probably more tractable, at least for us, than the one you will address at dinner this evening on the origin of life. So at the moment we keep more modest and we are just looking at the impact of digitalization on our area. Few words. Bruce Damer, he's a Canadian-American multinational and multidisciplinary scientist, designer and author. Dr. Damer collaborates with Professor David Deamer at UC Santa Cruz, where they have developed and are testing a new model for the origin of life on Earth. We'll hear more on that at dinner. Bruce began his career in the 1980s, developing some of the earliest user interfaces for personal computers. He led a community in the 1990s, bringing the first multi-user virtual worlds to the Internet. He hosted conferences on artificial intelligence and evolution. And since 2000, he has supported the NASA and the space industry on numerous simulations and spacecraft designed to provide a pathway for human civilization to expand beyond the Earth. He has also spent 25 years chronicling the history of computing in his DigiBarn Computer Museum. Dr. Damer's work and personal interests can be explored further at http://www.damer.com. So, Bruce, I leave you the floor. We can't wait more for...
See, this is the clicker here. Did you want to say something? Okay. Okay. So we're going to start at the beginning. As was said earlier, I'm a complete obsessive compulsive collector of vintage computer hardware. I got interested in this in the 80s when I was working with Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and asked the question, where did the mouse and the Ethernet and Windows and icons coming from? So I started to actually collect all the hardware. And the hardware you're going to see here is not mine, but it goes back even further. So what the question that I had was, how did we get here with computing architecture? Because we're all living within something called the von Neumann bottleneck. Does anyone know the von Neumann bottleneck? It means that data comes like an hourglass in from one end, goes through one or more processors, and ends up in a data store on the other end. And then you flip the hourglass around, and then it happens again. This is, in a sense, we're working through the hourglass, like looking through the hourglass that Alice was doing. So the question is, if we're working through the hourglass, can Alice or any of us reach the wonderland of AI, the promise of AI? and possibly not. So that's the question we're posing this morning. So in Tegmark's roadmap for AI to meet its long-term ambitions, which it means it needs to emulate natural systems, can we get there from here? Can we get to artificial narrow intelligence, general or superhuman intelligence with the computing hardware we have? And I don't believe we can. So just met Holger last night, and I found his essay on the site to be extremely sort of prescient and on the point, pointing out that effective AI algorithms are difficult to design, implement, and maintain. They also require a high level of expertise to deploy successfully in practice, and many stringent requirements on performance, robustness, predictability, and safety, as we're going to talk about here, will make this even harder in the future. So we're actually climbing up a slope here. It's almost like the beginnings of computing. It was very hard to do, not easy. So a question that both Holger and Tegmark ask, could AI systems themselves be used to design and code them in the future? Can we do that sort of stacking upon stacking that technology generally does? But the question underlying all of this, are our computing systems up to the task? So the answer, let's look back to the origins of computing. Deep in the 1930s, Alan Turing coming up with this universal computing mechanism in the mathematics that led to the Colossus running at Bletchley Park as the first data center in the world. And this is actually, I was given a tour of the Mark II, which is working and decodes German submarine codes. This fantastic data flow system. In the late 1940s, systems like ENIAC were programmed with plug boards on the outside, until I think Mockley or someone said, it makes no sense to work for 3 weeks to set up for a 30-minute calculation. You know, notice the ladies. They were the first computers. You know, they would not only set up things like ENIAC, but they actually did the manual calculator steps during the World War II and for NASA, as you saw in Hidden Figures, a tremendous documentary film. So enter John von Neumann. Now, John von Neumann, part of the Hungarian mafia, they included Edward Teller. They spoke in a code no one could break called Hungarian. I'm told that if you are not a baby being raised around Hungarians, you can never learn how to speak it. But anyway, so this was an important group in World War II. He was part of the Los Alamos project. And when he left Los Alamos, he decided to go and take up a position at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, working for Robert Oppenheimer, of course, who was the scientific director at Los Alamos. And because, as he said at the time, we're going to do something more important than the bomb. We're going to create automatic computing. So here's the institute on the left, established in the 1930s. It was established to be a place for pure thought, pure scholarship, without the messy inconvenience of students or laboratories. So my colleagues there are sort of it's sort of an academic tomb. It's the ivory tower's ivory tower. So in order for von Neumann to realize his vision, he had to actually hide the computing project away from Fold Hall, which is what you see here on the left. So they built this brick building, which is now the kindergarten, some distance from Fold Hall to do the ECP, the electronic computer at Princeton. And he came up with this mechanism so that in order not to have plugs going from the outside of the machine, they used Norbert Wiener's idea of cybernetics and feedback to have this bizarre and strangely alien concept of the instruction for the machine is in the same memory as is used to store its results. And it's completely internal, completely cybernetic. This is really before the understanding of how biology worked with RNA and DNA, which is also a completely cybernetic system. But this is his architecture, and it's the architecture we all use. It has one limitation. It has this bottleneck here. where everything is just pouring through the execution unit. So here's von Neumann in 1952 with the New York Times, where the launch of this wonderful machine. It had 2,000 vacuum tubes. It had these tubes down on the bottom are RCA storage tubes, cathode ray tubes that would read and write spots to give it a fast cache memory. The CPU is up above. They later added a drum. They added a card reader. And they created the model for computing. And what I went through all of von Neumann's archives about 10 years ago at the Institute to search for clues. And I found one letter that said, we don't want to file any patents or patents on this thing because we'll end up paying the lawyers more than it costs the machine. So what we will do is if you write to the Institute and you say, I'm you know, the Army Dugway Proving Ground, or I'm UCLA or whatever, and you want to be on our mailing list, we will send you quarterly reports on the progress of the construction of this machine, including all our ideas, all our questions, everything, and we'll just give it away. We'll open source it. So that if a lawyer should come to us, and this actually did happen, the IAS could say, oh, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to approach the U.S. Army. You're going to have to approach University of Illinois with your challenge, with your infringement claim. And it actually was a way to defend the innovation against the IP struggles that, say, for instance, happened around Edison's labs and Edison's innovations in the early part of the century. So this machine became distributed as an open source architecture, and this is why you're carrying one in your pocket today. There it is, it's in all its glory. I looked through the reports on the contractor who built the building. And the contractor was asking, let me understand, you need a Class A air evacuation system in a building which also has a chalkboard installed. We don't understand. Are they supposed to be two different rooms? No. They're using the mathematics to work the machine. So von Neumann, this is attributed to von Neumann. I'm actually working through George Dyson to figure out where this came. But this idea that the computer that they built at Princeton was a contingency design to just get some work done. But in no way does it represent a long-term solution for computing, especially when it comes to working with natural systems. So von Neumann felt, we just got this thing to work, and it actually won't do natural systems very well. And I'll show you how this panned out. So the first program for the ECP, which was called the Mathematics of the Machine, not a program, that's an interesting kind of evolution, was for nuclear weapons. It was actually used for one of the big nuclear weapons tests in the South Pacific. The second one was for weather prediction, computational meteorology. The third one is this program here. This is Niels Baricelli, who is a Norwegian-Italian investigator, a brilliant man, who wanted to try to simulate life on this thing. This is 1953. So this is some of his punch cards here and his notes. And this is the experiments in biometric evolution, bionumeric evolution, to find out if it's possible between bionumerical and biological phenomena, right, natural systems, and determine how heredity changes in selection to determine whether one organism is able to speed up their evolution by gene replacements. This is a big task for the first computer, programmable computer, right? And he was able to do things. So here are the Baricelli blueprints. And they're basically shots from either the cards or they're shots sometimes from the CRT of the data dump of the memory of these basically Conway's Game of Life in 1953. And you can see sort of almost like gliders going through there if you're A-Life aficionados. And however, this was very interesting to me to find this, because I was starting to work with this man, Freeman Dyson, who we know and love. And I met with him in his office and I said, Freeman, I just went through the archives, because he had rang them up so that I could go over and go through the whole archives. And I've determined that we're still hamstrung by the same problem of the von Neumann bottleneck. Because I was building a system called the Evolution Grid, which ended up running at UC San Diego, it had the same problems, the boundary problems of trying to simulate a large-scale multivariate, multi-object system where it would go across the boundary of the machine and have to go to the next tile. And how do you do selection, and how do you actually run what is effectively trying to be a natural system in a system that can't do it, that has this bottleneck, that has this hourglass? And these are my notes from talking to Freeman about it. And at that point, I thought, well, it's hopeless. We can't use digital computation to solve origin of life. We have to use chemistry, and you'll see that more of that tonight. So those are the notes for what eventually did get built within the limitations. So Peter Bentley at UCL has come up with this really wonderful table corresponding conventional and natural systems that compute, you know, your body versus your iPhone. And it's amazing. They're one-to-one diametrically opposed. The natural world computes in a different way, absolutely different way, very effectively in conventional computing for what we need to do. But if AI has this ambition to do more natural biological type things, it's running up against this hard limit. That the fact that there's virtually nothing that corresponds from the natural world into the digital world. There's virtually nothing. And so I'm not a big believer in the singularity, and I wrote so much to Ray Kurzweil. I did all the numbers for his singularity book, the computation curve numbers he shows. He hired me in like 2000, 2001 to do that, and I wrote him an essay why you couldn't claim anything from these numbers. Anyway, we had lunch later. I didn't bring it up. So here, let's take a look at the non-living world. Here's some gravel on the beach in Brighton. It supports a huge number of parallel innovation interactions, but they're finite and bounded. You know, they just happen and then they stop, basically like gravel moving. In the natural world, it supports infinitely repeatable computations in a way, in a massively parallel fashion, that are unbounded. They just keep going and going and going, driven by cycles of energy. Let's look deeper. So here's E. coli. It's a massive parallel computing universe. This is from David Goodsell's wonderful book. If you really want to take a look inside the cell, you should read Goodsell's book on the machinery of life. Now, to give you an idea of the breathtaking scope of computation going on in the cell, take a look at this. This is 100 nanometer volume of cytoplasm, 100 nanometers on the side. This is not a big part of the cell. This is what it contains, 450 proteins. These are tools that fold and do things and catalyze things and break things, 450 in that volume, 30 ribosomes. These are the huge chemical factories that make the proteins. You know, tRNA on the way to the ribosome, 340 of those, messenger RNA molecules, 30,000 small molecules that feed the system, amino acids, nucleotides, sugars, ATP, in that tiny volume, super crowded, 50,000 ions of various types. And the 70% is water, and the water is the mechanism that slams everything around and bangs everything and kind of gets it into place. Now, this may not run. No, that didn't run. So there's vast computing going on in biology that we can learn from. It's a different style of computing. But if we look at the evolution of our computing from the ECP to supercomputing grids to parallel processing, which is, they are still all von Neumann machines, right? And we're pushing the limits. We're pushing more of those spreadsheets and payroll and everything and word processing through that one pipe. And it seems to us we're making progress. But since von Neumann machines have taken over the world, could they simulate the action of a single living cell? Well, I did some calculation with friends in the supercomputing community, and we looked at a single neuron. And we looked at the molecular dynamics level simulation of one neuron with all its dendrites and axons and things like this. And we looked at just the MD costs for doing everything. And it came down to the 10 top supercomputing networks in the world put together could not do one neuron, period, in any kind of predictive fashion. So all of these efforts to do sort of cog brain kinds of things that are saying, well, just make a simplified neuron. What do you simplify out of the equation? What do you not include? So they couldn't simulate, all the computers in the world probably couldn't simulate this. We're underpowered by 6 orders of magnitude. So, but can the next generation of AI move to a new computing paradigm? And I believe that it can, but we have to actually start work on this now. And we'll take this up at dinner. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce, for this fascinating introduction. So it's our task now to develop this new AI and to think of the policy conditions for developing this new AI over the coming 2 days. The bad news is that we are a bit late and we'll have no time for Q&A, but I invite you to go to Bruce directly at coffee break. You'll still be there and available for interactions. And so we move now to the next session.
So we're moving to the next session, the one that starts at 9:45. It's not too bad, and it's the session on blockchain facilitating integrity, reproducibility, and scope in science and innovation. Moderator is Catherine Mulligan, a visiting researcher at Imperial College London and CTO of GovTech Lab at University College London. Please.
So, hi everyone, good morning, and thank you for that really interesting presentation. It was really fascinating. I was taking lots of notes. And now to something a lot less intelligent, if I may be a little bit facetious, which is blockchain. I think we've got four. Sorry, I should say that as someone who's a big proponent of blockchain as well. I'm often advocating for it. So, but we're not quite at the level of AI with blockchain. But it's a super fascinating topic and one that I think has really profound impact for the way that we do research and also potentially how we think about defining what the real problems are. But we've got four great speakers today. We're opening with Joris van Rossum, who's Director of Special Projects of Digital Science London, and he's going to talk to us about using blockchain to improve scientific publishing.
Good morning, everyone. Let me see if this works. Yeah, so I'm with Digital Science. Digital Science is a technology company based in London, and what we try to do is to make science more efficient, more transparent by means of technology, and we do that by investing in companies, supporting researchers in all stages of the workflow, but also investing in initiatives like blockchain. I wrote a report for Digital Science in November last year, which is ages in terms of blockchain, where I kind of highlighted the ideas around blockchain and how it could improve science, research, scholarly communication. And I'm also leading initiative with several publishers in trying to apply blockchain to make peer review more transparent and more efficient. We had a very nice discussion yesterday night, and we had just a discussion now. It was very nice to see that all the challenges in scholarly communication and research are actually quite relevant to blockchain. Just to highlight, I would say, are the four most important challenges that we're facing today. The one is reproducibility, or the lack of reproducibility. That discussion started like 8-9 years ago when people started to reproduce the research that was published in psychology. And it turned out that about 2/3 of the research was not reproducible, or to say it in layman's terms, were not true, which is shockingly for two reasons. First of all, it turns out that a lot of research is not true, but also apparently we're not aware of it. So that's quite a big issue. The second problem that we're facing in scholarly communication and research in general is limited metrics. Traditionally, researchers are assessed based on two data points, and that's the number of publications and the number of citations. But there are many other activities that are equally important in science. Linked to that, journal publications are still the main outlet for research assessment. But of course, journals are looking for specific data, that is positive results. But negative results, which can be equally important, are not published, which is a challenge. Third problem is peer review. Also had a discussion about it just now. Lack of recognition, a lack of efficiency in the process, and overall lack of transparency. It's very much a black box. The fourth one is the commercial crisis. Science is, per definition, a non-commercial activity, but ironically, it's one of the most profitable businesses in the world, which is a challenge, but there's also a challenge with business models in general. Now, in theory, and I'm stressing here, in theory, all of them could be solved by blockchain. And I'm going to talk about this by not explaining blockchain in detail. We don't have the time for that. But really looking at the technology from three different angles and explain how that could relate to science and how it could make research, but also communication around research, more efficient. So this is my favorite way of thinking about blockchain. It is an evolution from the Internet of Information to the Internet of Value. And we mean by that is the following. Of course, the Internet is based on copying. Whenever I share information, whenever I communicate, whenever I download a file, it is a copy of the code that is on somebody else's computer, which is extremely efficient when you think about, indeed, exchange of information. But of course, when you exchange value, that cannot be based on copying. If I hand over you well, apparently you don't use any physical money anymore in Norway, but if I would give you physical money, you want to make sure it's not, put it on the copy machine. That's why when you exchange value over the internet, you need a bank. You need an intermediary to make sure that that indeed the money transferred from one person to the other. There's no double spending, for example. But the blockchain, the revolutionary aspect, is that now you can transfer value without an intermediary, without a third party. And that's, I think, really one of the most revolutionary aspects of this technology. Now, the most logical consequence of that application is cryptocurrencies, of course. Bitcoin, but there are about 1,500 cryptocurrencies now. So how could that help scientists? How could that improve scientific process? Well, actually, in the last year, we've seen quite some initiatives around that. And what they propose is that a token for scientists should be introduced. And the idea is that whenever a scientist performs a certain activity, for example, when they perform a peer review, they would get certain tokens. And these tokens then can be used to, for example, pay for an article processing fee or to purchase a statistical analysis. So the idea here is that you would create an economy around science that would solve the problems we have around motivation and the lack of incentives for certain important activities but undervalued activities, for example, peer review. And even, for example, funding could take place by the means of these tokens. But when we talk about value, of course, it's not just money. It's also content. It's also published articles, books. And the problem, again, also here is with the internet, that every computer basically is a printing press. I can just, in a second, copy my PDF millions of times. Well, million is maybe a bit too much, but it's extremely simple to copy material. The challenge in terms of business models here is that there is no business model that can be directly tied to that copying. Using the internet, it's very expensive and cumbersome to make micropayments. So micropayments, of course, is the most logical way to connect the business model with copying. Whenever you download something, you pay a smaller fee. For this reason, digital publishers, but also academic publishers, are relying on different business models. For example, advertisements. And that has been, of course, extremely negative, for example, for the newspaper industry, because the search engine giants and Facebook are taking 2/3 of the advertisement money. So it's a huge challenge for the newspaper industry and for the news exchange in general. In academic publishing, we don't rely on advertisement, but on two other models. That is subscriptions, which leads to paywalls, which are very unpopular, also because, of course, the expectation with the internet is that everything should be free. So this is a very unpopular way. And we have open access. open access, of course, has been around for about 20 years. And, well, slowly we realized that it's not as successful as we thought it would be. I think the latest count, only 30% of articles are open access. And open access, of course, led to its own set of problems. We have predatory publishers. We have the fear that commercial incentives will intervene with editorial standards, for example. And we have a new barrier for authors from the global south that can't get published anymore in the journals of choice. So again, the micropayments could also be a sustainable and alternative business model in academic publishing and solve the commercial crisis that we're facing. But there's more to that. Smart contracts, basically you code certain contracts in the blockchain, and whenever there's a trigger, it's executed. That's also very interesting when you think about digital rights, permissions, royalties, for example. So if I produce a digital content, I can write in the blockchain, well, I wrote it, I have a co-author, and he owns 30%, the price is $10, and, for example, I give permissions for people to reuse the images. So in that way, a very cumbersome process now can be done way more efficiently. The second level, I have three levels to think about blockchain, is through thinking about it as a system that creates timestamps and hashes, which is inherent to the technology. Which means that I can always prove that I was the one that, for example, uploaded content or an article. And I can also do that in a confidential way. So nobody can actually see without my permission that I was the one that uploaded that content. This aspect of blockchain is very interesting when you think about exchanging data sharing. We all know being more open about data, sharing data is extremely important for science. It would make science more reproducible, for example, it would improve the peer review. But in the survey a couple of months ago, researchers were asked, well, why don't you share more data? And there were two reasons given why they didn't do it. First of all, what's in it for me? I don't get a citation, it doesn't count in my research assessment. And second, I'm afraid I will lose intellectual property. If I share my data, somebody else can use it. That means that people wait with sharing the data until the publication, until the article is published, and then even they are restricted in sharing the data. The blockchain could solve that, actually, by using those two aspects. First of all, whenever I share content or data on the blockchain, I can always prove it was me that uploaded the data. But I can only reveal my identity whenever I feel it's the right time. So it works as a notarization system. And second, the combination of tokenization could create an incentive. So whenever I upload the data, I can just write in a contract if somebody will reuse that data, credit me, but also, for example, provide me some tokens. So these are just some examples that were launched in last year that focus on those aspects. Encouraging researchers to exchange data with tokenization and notarization function as important aspects to that. I think we're going to hear of initiative concrete later on. The third and last level to think about blockchain is to think about it as basically in the most basic level, it's a new way of storing data. It's a new kind of data storage. With three very special aspects. First is decentralized. So again, like with Bitcoin, there is no central authority. So the trust that you normally need is taken over by technology. It's distributed. So basically, it's not one copy, but their copies are spread over different nodes. And the third one, which is also extremely relevant for science, is that it's transparent. So everybody can see the transactions, but it's pseudonymous. So you don't necessarily see the people behind the transactions. So that could be relevant for science and the challenges we talked about around scientific scholarly communication in two ways. I just want to give two examples. Also, just now, we talked about the problems in... I have a technical problem. Yeah, it doesn't work. Next slide, anyone? Yeah, it's here. Yes, perfect. Okay, great. Peer review. Again, we had a very interesting discussion just now. Everybody agrees peer review is an important process in validating research, in bringing material to the right community by means of journals. At the same time, there are challenges. There are challenges with recognition. Again, research assessment is based on publications, on citations. Review is mostly a hidden process. There are some initiatives that try to improve that, for example, Publons. But again, the recognition that people get for review is too low. And then transparency. It's an extremely important process, but it's a black box. Basically, the information is kept within the walls of the publisher. And coordination. Especially with the rise from publications from China, there are many, many more papers, but too few reviewers to review the papers, which again leads to the fact that people get too many invitations, etc. So we believe that creating an infrastructure to share the information between all the participants in the ecosystem will improve the process. So we're talking about publishers, submission systems, we're talking about institutions and organizations like ORCID. Because, for example, if you're a publisher and you want to invite a reviewer and you know that the reviewer did, like, say, relevant reviews for other journals, which are maybe part of a different publisher, if you know that, for example, the reviewer is currently conducting a review for another journal, you might not, for example, invite him or her. So by sharing information, we can increase the coordination and thereby the efficiency of the whole process. By storing the information around research activities, again, we're not storing the reports themselves, but really, you know, who did the review, when were they invited, what was the acceptance rates, that kind of information. We can also recognize them better, because recognition starts with having the data in the first place. And also very important, again, the transparency. Peer review is an essential process in research validation, and we need to have a central place where we store that information. Now, the big challenge, of course, here is trust. We have single-blind, double-blind models. We have, of course, interest between publishers. So how do we make sure that people are comfortable, that publishers are comfortable with sharing peer review information? How can they be sure that confidential information is not shared, while information that is shareable is made available? And here the blockchain can be very instrumental, because first of all, it's decentralized. So as a community, as an ecosystem, we can share data and not having to rely on a third party, let alone a commercial party. Also, that pseudonymous nature is extremely important, because we can be transparent about the process, but we don't have to share confidential information like the names of the reviewers, for example, or the names of the articles that were reviewed. So it makes it a very natural technology to be more open, to be more transparent about the research process as an ecosystem, and thereby making the process more efficient. So the blockchain for peer review was launched to improve the peer review process. We're working together with ORCID, but also funders, Wellcome Trust is an advisor, and we currently have four publishers participating: Springer Nature, Taylor & Francis, Kager, and Cambridge University Press. I just want to end the use cases, because I think I'm going maybe a bit over my time, with giving an even bigger picture about the potential application of blockchain. This is just not a very nice image, but it's tried to demonstrate all the different systems a researcher will have to work with before a paper is published. So you start to collect your data, for example, on the LabGuru or another software. You write your first version of words. You have your Excel sheet. You submit your first version, for example, to FictShare or to an institutional repository. You send it to a publisher. You go through editorial manager, etc., etc. So what if you would have one system that collects all these activities for researchers? So whenever a researcher gets funded, whenever they perform a peer review, whenever they collect data, whenever they perform statistical analysis, and whenever they submit, get cited, etc. The advantages would be numerous. Think about the limited metrics. We would have more data points than just the citations and the publications. So we can assess the researcher in a more balanced way, and thereby solve the problems with the limited metrics. But also, reproducibility. Again, it's a big, big challenge. It erodes the trust in science, also in society. This is a very nice image from Dr. Sunke Bartling. He's from the Blockchain for Science group in Berlin. Basically, again, when you start to share data on the blockchain, science becomes more open, more transparent, and also more reproducible. So blockchain, very important point. It's a nascent technology. The first discussions, of course, it's the blockchain celebrated its 10th anniversary last month with a paper on Bitcoin. discussions around science and blockchain started about 3 years ago. So Scholarly Kitchen is an important blog, then you saw the first discussions. Last year, you really saw the first, the ideas. I think 2017 was really the year of ideas. And this year, actually, you see an explosion. Well, you see many, many initiatives within this sphere, ranging really from, you know, platforms that basically want to disrupt the entire systems to industry initiatives that try to tackle one specific problem, such as peer review. So it's a very exciting area. Again, it's early days. It will take years before this will have an impact. But again, the potential, in theory, it's very relevant to the challenges we have in science today. Last slide. The policy, just to end with that, very important, of course, because whenever we talk about a new business model, it's extremely related to government, because they're the biggest client of science. We have to think about research assessment, which is also a question of policy and government policy. And of course, whenever we think about funding and we want to change that, that also very much relates to the whole policy aspect of science. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we'll take questions, I think, at the end for the panel. So next up we have Mirjana Stankovic, from the Tambourine Innovation Ventures in Washington, D.C., who will talk to us about using blockchain to facilitate innovation in the creative economy. Thank you
very much. So hello, everyone. It is a pleasure being with you all here. Thank you. A big thank you to the OECD team who invited me to be here with you today. Today I will give an overview of the key forces behind blockchain that might empower the creative economy stakeholders such as artists, innovators and alike. I will also highlight the main challenges inherent to blockchain. So blockchain is a distributed ledger technology that comes in many forms, and this is very important to remember from a legal point of view. It can be permissionless, permission, public, private, hybrid. Its main advantages, as already highlighted, are transparency, blockchain is tamper-proof, resiliency. If permissionless, blockchain also removes the intermediary, so as it serves as a peer-to-peer, P2P network. Blockchain can enable creative stakeholders unlock new financing opportunities, as already highlighted, circumvent intermediaries without having to sacrifice their ownership and contract rights. And this can be fascinating, and this is very indeed fascinating. In the creative economy, blockchain can redefine how creative stakeholders get remunerated. For instance, a common complaint which is lodged by musicians and artists in general is that as collective management societies and new intermediaries such as Spotify and YouTube insert themselves into the value chain, artists receive smaller cuts of revenue and have less say over how their creative works are priced, shared, or advertised. Blockchain or some forms of blockchain might be able to solve this problem. While it is difficult to predict how things will evolve because it's a nascent technology, I see six distinct forces behind blockchain that might influence the creative industry. Force number one, democratizing data and putting ownership back into hands of creators. In blockchain, data is replicated across several unrelated nodes, that is computers. No single node can act as a gatekeeper, and this is very, very important, and assume control of data. Events are recorded and stored in a permanent and verifiable way. So it's very difficult to tamper with data. Users who store data on the blockchain retain access to it via encryption keys. So some blockchains, not all of them, remove the need for central authority and thus act as a democratizing force. Blockchain could also act as a timestamp register and bring transparency to who the owner of the creative content is. So if you're a musician and you upload, your data on the blockchain, everybody will know that you are the author of the song, for example. Services, and there are certain services that exist, for example, Bindit offers to attribute ownership of creative works securely by providing each creative work with unique cryptographic ID verified with the blockchain. This means that ownership can be traced and creative content securely shared. This empowers not only the creatives, the IP owners, but also the consumers. And it's been suggested that blockchain platforms can be used for IP enforcement, but we are not still there. This remains disputable. So force number two, blockchain might be used as an instrument for efficient IP management, as already mentioned. And smart contracts, which are self-executable code, can be used for revenue sharing. Blockchain can be used by IP owners to store hashed digital certificates of their IPRs. They could use blockchain to license, assign, and transfer IPRs via smart contracts. And this is not just in the creative industry, but also it can be used by technology transfer offices for streamlining the process. And this is called digital rights management via P2P network. For instance, smart contracts can define, and this was already mentioned, which percentage of the revenue goes to, for example, which member of the band, the label, the manager, etc. Blockchain can also ease licensing by giving a quick way to contact all involved right holders, which is a huge issue in the creative industry. Artists can be remunerated and collect royalties instantly instead of waiting for months or years, as is the case now. Blockchain can also influence the way creative stakeholders interact with their fans. So it could be a direct way for reaching out to fans. Artists through smart contracts can share a percentage of their revenue with fans who actively promote their creative works, and this is through tokens, as it has been already mentioned. Inventors could also use blockchain to for technology scouting, identification, upload and exchange of invention disclosure records, etc., etc. So NDAs, for example, non-disclosure agreements could be executed via blockchain. Inventions could preserve their novelty through encryption. And force number three is transparent and secure P2P transactions, and I have already talked about that. And this is this is one of the examples of platforms that are used by creatives and IP owners for digital rights management. It's called PeerTrax. They can seek immediate royalty payments and ownership. It works by attaching smart contracts to every work, creative work that's been uploaded on the platform. Then you have another example. This is the Ujo platform and the famous artist Imogen Heap, who is a pioneer in this respect for promoting blockchain for the creative industry. Another example is Koala IP, which is a blockchain-ready, community-driven protocol for IP licensing, and this is being used by the PeerTrax, for example, platform. It offers low-friction IP management. It can be used with all media. It's open, it offers blockchain supported secure attribution and licensing, and it's network agnostic. And another platform, which is being used by some musicians, mostly independent, is Mycelia, again founded by Imogen Heap. It's currently, most of these initiatives are in alpha testing or beta testing mode. So it's not the platform has not been accepted by many creatives, and it's kind of cryptic, and we have to work more in order to, educate the general public and the consumers what the benefits of blockchains are. Force 5 efficient and dynamic pricing and micrometering and micromonetizing. Micrometering and micromonetizing was already covered. So creative content is oftentimes mispriced. By tracking the demand for creative content, pricing could be more dynamic, and blockchain can offer this. Snippets of creative works could be made available for a price, for example, a few seconds of a song for use in a movie trailer, and consumers or businesses could easily identify who the creator of the music work is. There is one business, one blockchain platform that was established in 2015, but it's a failed story in this respect for micrometering and micromonetizing in the creative industry. And I'm not aware that there are any others out there, but as a concept, this can be very fascinating. Force 6, establishing a reputation system. Blockchain might be used as an instrument repository for linking reputations to specific addresses on the blockchain. Producers and consumers of creative content can easily verify one another, and potential users are not in the creative field. Apart from copyrights, it might be useful for trademarks also, for tracking the origin of the goods and protecting against piracy and counterfeiting. So now comes the fun part, risk, challenges, and the future. So although blockchain presents interesting features in terms of transparency, security, immutability, it can be changed, the data can be changed that easily once it's there on the blockchain, traceability and automation, its wide-scale deployment currently hinges on various challenges. Scalability remains limited. Existing blockchain networks and platforms do not talk to each other. This is the issue of interoperability, and I think it would be quite a challenge to go past that. And there are numerous unresolved legal issues. So, and also, I would like to mention that blockchain is energy intensive as a solution. So, in the context of climate change and sustainability, we have to take into account this feature of blockchain as well. So while some artists embrace blockchain as a way to release tracks and gain greater control of their careers, blockchain-ready artists remain a very small minority. While blockchain may provide creators with a larger say and stakes in the revenue generated, questions remain as to what extent they can market and promote their creative content without the help of traditional agents. And also, the technical understanding of the consumers and the inertia of the consumers to switch from traditional online platforms to blockchain-supported platforms, because usually when people think of blockchain, they think of Bitcoin, okay? On-chain versus off-chain storage, and I'm thinking as a lawyer now, data. So questions remain about where the creative media will be stored. On the blockchain itself, is metadata or in the form of access keys. Current technology may constrain putting creative content directly on the blockchain, while storing just the metadata presents issues of where the actual work would be stored and the data that are associated with the actual work and how this is going to be disseminated. So data ownership, liability regarding data, remains an issue that it's going to be that should be resolved by regulation. Methodology for micrometering, micromonetizing. Bitcoin itself, and there are different types of blockchains, it's not just Bitcoin, is not originally designed for micropayment features, thus requiring an off-chain layer that handles payments. So this complicates things. Legal and regulatory challenges, jurisdiction. So blockchain is a technology that that knows no boundaries. We'll also challenge the centralized system of registering patents, trademarks, and industrial designs if used for IP management. The tamper-proof design can be seen as a disadvantage because it is impossible to make corrections in the systems in the system. And this is very, very important for you to remember that smart contracts are code and they cannot be changed. They are self-executable, okay? And the law and the regulations should provide for certain situations where a remedy is useful, and smart contracts do not allow for this. What else? Okay. Couple of, but we can discuss. Yeah, a lot of challenges. Thank you.
Very much for inviting me here. This is certainly a very interesting event that I have been looking forward very much, even though I was not very communicative, as you know. Okay, so I'm myself heading a center of excellence that works in biomedical sciences, but it has started to use ledger technology in its project flow. And that may be one of the reasons why I give here a short presentation, and I will do it very much from the angle of an active research scientist. Let me see how that works. So in the usual academic research cycle, we have several steps, starting from the evaluation of the idea, getting the inspiration to do a certain experiment. The first thing we're looking at is for funding. We need to get some resources to do the experiment. Then we do the experiment, then we get acquisition of data, we process the data, we analyze them, and then finally we collect the data for publication based on the findings. We may or may not get a follow-up idea that again needs funding. And the big question is, can technology, and in particular, as this session is now about blockchain, can somehow support, enhance, and improve the different steps in that cycle? Now, in my presentation, as time is very short, I will predominantly focus on this side of the chain, where we have very well established, but very insufficiently working peer-to-peer processes. And that's, of course, in the publication step, which is an intense peer-to-peer process. I will not talk so much about that because it has already been touched. But then also in the funding process, which again is a very intense peer-to-peer process. But it may offer unique opportunities for blockchain-based solutions. I will also briefly touch data storage, project logistics, supply data processing, but
as time is very short, I will really just only touch that. First of all, I will come with a list of miseries. If you start to talk about funding with the scientists, you will end up with the big blues mostly. In the developed world, I just will briefly touch that, many scientists feel that we are stagnant and uneven public science funding. We have low funding rates and we use excessive time for fundraising, most of us at least. We feel that we have an over-bureaucratization and a massive third-party involvement. Not everybody in the research administration may agree, but we certainly think so. Sometimes we feel when we have a really exciting idea and want to recruit good researchers that we do see a declining recruitment of top human resources, and we're a bit worried about that. That's in the developed world. If we look into the developing world, which I think we sometimes should care about too, things look even considerably worse. So there's a lack of infrastructure, lack of possibilities for developing and keeping human resources, and that leads to a phenomenon that has all touched us in the last years in one or the other way, and that's an emerging mass migration. And so I just want to show you a few pictures that have been taken from the internet. That is a distribution of science funding in the world. You see, it overlaps pretty much with the OECD, where things are reasonably okay, but in the rest of the world, things are very, very poor to some extent, and that's a complete loss of human possibilities, I think, and human resources that shouldn't be acceptable. Now, if you look at the funding distributed over different countries and territories, you will see that most of the research funding is indeed in the countries that represent the OECD. China's coming up heavily, but if you look at the it's horrible. Don't you hear me?
Yes, but
I mostly talk here. Okay. Okay. So that looks grim, doesn't it? I think it's very worrying that we have such large unevenness. If you look at the reward for outstanding science as to who and where Nobel Prizes are given, things look maybe even grimmer. These are things we can't accept. And the question is whether the emerging world of blockchain can help somehow, at least to relieve a bit this situation. Now, if we go back to our own territory, there is not only the sentiment that science funding is getting worse and more difficult for our scientists, but indeed we see that the success rate of grant applications is dropping, and that's something that should concern us. And although that is not everywhere in the world, in China, scientific spending is massively increasing, but in our parts, things start to deteriorate to some extent, and we should see whether we can take some kind of actions. Just again, to come from a more individual level, seen from a scientist, you will face a structure that causes high costs for middlemen and organizations that are denting in the budgets that are available for scientists. So typically, we're very concerned about the getting most out of the funding that society puts into science. But we would see that about 5 to 15% of the funding volume goes into middlemen that communicate between the peer and peer process. And just for Norway, as we're here, the numbers I've seen is that the Research Council of Norway takes about 77% of the science funding that the government publicly puts in place, which are 640 million Norwegian kroners in 2017. If you project that on the world academic R&D, you end up almost with 50 billion USD. That's a lot of money for a middleman structure. So even if we can't possibly easily increase the total science funding, maybe we can do a little fix on that, and you always get you already may get the idea that blockchain could be a solution to at least get some reward and some reduction of this middleman structure. We also note that fundraising through the existing middleman structure is a very time-consuming process. In the case of the Center of Excellence that we got rewarded, it took almost 2 years from the initial application to the reward. That are very long timelines, which delay science in a way that may be improved through digital technologies. I already have been talking about the low success rate. And this just visualizes the current system and also hopefully the promise of a more decentralized system as blockchain technology can offer. So in the current system, you have a peer-to-peer system, but the peer-to-peer system is not direct. It includes middlemen, and those middlemen get bigger and bigger through time. So only the Research Council of Norway in the last 10 years has doubled its budget for its services. It's also a system that is that offers only limited choices. It's rather linear from the peer that is applying, say, for funding to the peers that review his request for funding. And obviously, if the system is linear, it's not as open and successful and flexible as it could be with a decentralized structure. So the promise that blockchain technology is doing is that a peer, instead of having to go through a linear middleman controlled structure, has an open choice, both to choose the middleman that he wants, but also the peers that may be around in the system in a rather free flow of information. As we have very limited time, I cannot go into much technical details. I just want to briefly mention that the benefits of such a structure could be increased efficacy and reduced costs for the peer-to-peer review, reduced thematic bias of public funding, a potential, hopefully, evening out of geographical restrictions, and hopefully using financial algorithms, maybe additional funding can be created by a science token system. This is something we can take at the dinner, how this could possibly implement it. But there are some economic models that allow a process of a modest quantitative easing by creating science tokens. So, of course, we using a blockchain-based system for science funding will not necessarily substitute existing structures, but it may give an additional supplement that can help us scientists to have more choices and possibly get funding quicker for our research projects and at places that normally wouldn't have access to good funding and infrastructure. I want very quickly, and my time is running out, also have a comment on the right-hand side of this graph, data storage, project logistics, supply, data processing. That is a big area for blockchain. I do not want to go into much details other than just saying that there are lots of potential benefits of using blockchain technology for that side of the value chain, and that is digital object identifiers can be introduced in blockchain technology, timestamp, immutability, trust systems. You can have various levels of decentralization, smart contracts, decentralization, and you can have an organization of human resources idea through systems like ORCID, for example. The arena of blockchain developers is exploding. It almost doesn't make any sense to go into much details. This is a map of developers in blockchain applications for science that has been published by John Broke in April this year. This map is already much outdated, and I just want to pinpoint a few companies. There are many more around. Some of them we already have heard. So there are developers working on ownership and attribution, artifacts and Nobel are some that have been mentioned. Logistics and data management plus publishing, there is an exploding arena of different companies that work on that. Frankl is one that has already been mentioned. Orbium, Pluto Network, Science Route, Open Science Network, Eureka in Zurich, that is very busy setting up micropublishing systems, Catalysis. We do not have time to go into that. What it shows is that there's a lot of activity and interest in developing both the technological platforms, but also the economic framework for making such a blockchain-based operation economically viable. And in funding, the theme that I'm most concerned about at this talking, we also have some players that start to find an economic system how to make science funding possible using blockchain solutions. My impression is that none of them has the key yet. None of them has a really convincing solution how science funding can be implemented by blockchain solutions. I just want to mention Matrix, Open Science Network, and DIEP in Minsk. There are several more. All of them are extremely early stage. If it can be realized to use blockchain by science funding, we need to be very aware of some issues. And that is, we need to be extremely careful about providing token value stability. You can't have a science coin that is jumping around in value from day to day. We need to have trust systems against misuse, for instance, money laundering. We cannot have a science token system that is used for money laundering. We must have a very firm legal and regulatory framework. We must have high academic standards, and this is very important for the blockchain community. We have to have backing from governmental research and philanthropic organizations to get that implemented. I probably am running out of my time. I have two more slides. What my hope and recommendation is for the policy makers is create a permissive environment for experimental testing, and have it very carefully followed by academic organization to have the stringency you need to see whether the data and the models that are used are well funded, have a good foundation. Provide funds for technology development, academic interrogation, homogenized legislation, very important for international systems, and enable state agencies to invest on a test base in exploratory projects. That would be a financial system that could help tokenization of science funding. This is my last slide, and that's important for policymakers. Politics is more difficult than physics. I think that blockchain technology can resolve a number of issues, but we do need the backing of politicians to enable the systems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm being a little bit draconian on time so that we can actually have a discussion at the end. Next up is Chirdeep Chabra, the founder of Ocean Protocol Foundation, and he's going to talk to us about their AI and blockchain solution for safe data sharing.
I assume I have just 2 minutes. I'm going to skip a lot of slides. Thank you for the invitation. Really appreciate that. So this is something we are all grappling with, right? This is something which we all know. Data is growing exponentially. We are going to have about 160 plus zettabytes of data by 2025. But the reality is less than 1% of unstructured data is being analyzed today. That's a huge loss of potential, right? And last decade saw data being thrown out at such amazing volumes, mostly to do with cloud, with mobile, and with some of these platforms that we see here that actually ended up with those. These things happened because we had these very thin protocols which actually are open source out there, things like HTML with HTTP and so on, and applications like Facebook and so on that actually created massive applications on top of it, mostly by collecting data. And they all have our data, but then that basically led to silos. Now, what's the other thing that we have seen? Deep learning absolutely loves data. AI, right until, I would say, right from 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, we had the scenario where most researchers, and believe me, I was in research for about 8 years. I'm a failed PhD. I actually walked out of it when I was told that some of the things that I was doing in AI, my dad used to do the same thing. So I actually had to rethink my life. Where error rates, where we were seeing error rates falling from 25% to 5% if we threw 1,000 times more data, and we throw another 1,000 times more data, we see error rates fall from about 5% to close to 1% or lower. Now, that kind of situation, which was really brought about by cloud computing, by actually the falling of prices of storage and compute, really brought about a very interesting change, bringing AI into the hands of many. Now, that's what it's all about, feeding the AI beast. Sorry, I'm going to skip a number of slides just because I think you all know what I'm talking about here. So, but what we are really seeing is this AI arms race, and it actually is very, very interesting. PwC predicts that there'll be a gain of about 15.7 trillion in global GDP by 2030. And it seems like China is actually winning that race. And the US, well, it's now questionable. Is where it is, right? But then there is the rest of the world that's actually catching up. And the reality is this AI arms race is a kind of a misnomer. It's supposed to be more of a data sharing race that it should be, which we are not recognizing. And that's where I think we need a massive change. What really is happening is AI and data are not connecting. There's a huge disconnect. There are startups and research and companies. I actually started 4 AI companies in the past, and I can tell you that I was drowning in algorithms. What I didn't have was data, and I would go begging for data. And those large companies that are digitizing at very high speeds today actually do not have the skills and are not of the sort like the Facebooks of the world or the Googles of the world, who actually have both data and AI skills. So there's a huge disconnect that we are seeing. And that led me to actually look at data marketplaces much more closely. And I actually last year joined DEX, which was a centralized data marketplace, as a CEO. And basically within 8 weeks went back to my chairman and said, centralized data marketplaces will not work because of trust issues, right? The question, whenever I would actually go and ask for some data, basically I would get some copies of data from large organizations with a lot of value. They wouldn't give me their gold nuggets. What I would get is things which would not be the most important and the most valuable stuff. But in spite of that, the kind of things that we actually ended up looking at is the problems around compliance, around regulation, around consent, who owns the data, how do we actually manage the data, what about some kind of traceability of the data. We as centralized data marketplaces were not able to kind of promise any of that or not be able to show any of that. And most importantly, most data providers saw themselves as losing control as they would give a copy of the data to me. Even if I signed a 500-page document bringing in lawyers for 6 months discussing that with me, that is wrong, right? So that led me to think decentralization is the solution, but also I'm actually pretty annoyed when people actually bring up blockchain and say it's a solution to everything. What we actually saw here was blockchain really provided us certain solutions we absolutely needed. You heard earlier this morning about moving from Internet of Information to Internet of Value. So data becomes value, it becomes an asset. Truly becomes an asset when you actually bring it on board onto blockchain. So we basically, from centralized data exchanges to decentralized data exchanges, what we actually moved to is from rigid bespoke solutions to a protocol. So instead of going and solving one point-to-point solution, I actually work on a protocol which provides those rules in terms of how you can actually ask for certain kinds of access controls. You're sure about what kind of access controls are possible and how they can be provided. right? You move from negotiated agreements to actually market pricing, right? You move from so where in centralized marketplaces there are lots of questions about around traceability and audit. You move from that to records which actually kind of control and actually prove provenance. That becomes a very interesting thing as AI is moving into a space where it becomes a question of life and death. The questions that are being asked about data is it fake data or not? What is the provenance of the data, right? So those kind of questions are very important. Then we move from some kind of manual audit and verification to cryptographic proofs and move from point-to-point solutions to actually building a whole data ecosystem and building what I would call as the new data economy and the new AI economy. I'm going to skip that. So why is Ocean decentralized? Right. So the data owner retains control of the data. If you don't have the keys, you do not control the data. Right. Now, this is becoming increasingly important because more and more organizations who actually sit on some of this data are not able to really prove today who actually owns the data. But they do have consent for certain things. But how do we actually move forward with that? OK, the second thing is it really must be a public utility versus controlled by a single entity. That is extremely important. We need to have this anti-pattern to Facebook, right? So that's something that's important, right? Now, and allow for block rewards and incentivized data supply. Now, one of the least talked about things about blockchain is incentivization. How do we actually incentivize the entire ecosystem to actually do the right things? For example, curation marketplaces, right? So that curation actually brings the most valuable data right up. You know, if we actually have all that data onto a marketplace that 165 zettabytes, you need a mechanism to actually make sure that there's incentives to kind of bring the right kind of data sets up. But also the entire data supply chain has so many other tasks, whether it is in terms of data labeling, data cleaning, and so on. How do we actually incentivize that entire ecosystem to actually get built? So that's where blockchain plays a massive role. So I'm going to skip that, but let's go on to this. So what we are really saying as Ocean Protocol is let's use blockchain to connect data and AI so that we can build a new data economy that unlocks data and value and gives power back to you and me. And so a brief thing about Ocean Protocol. Ocean Protocol Foundation is a nonprofit foundation based in Singapore. There are two companies who formed it, DEX. I'm the CEO of DEX, which used to be a centralized data marketplace. We actually shut down that business, and we are absolutely concentrating on building Ocean Protocol. BigchainDB is a blockchain company based in Berlin. They've been building scalable blockchain databases for the last 5 years. We got together to form this, and I'm going to skip that. So this is where we are. We actually released our testnet in August, testnet version 1. Testnet version 2 will be released end of this month, and we are on for releasing our network in March next year. Pirates? Yes, pirates. Well, it's Ocean. You need pirates. We are pirates in some way. So, so Ocean is the block as the backbone of the new data economy. So what we are really doing is trying to bring about this entire ecosystem on top of Ocean in a way that actually really makes a difference. We are working with the regulators in Singapore, the Infocom Media Development Authority, and also with PwC to build the trust framework. So while blockchain does actually remove the need for trust in certain elements, it is a trustless system, there are places where we'll actually have this hybrid system of trust and trustless. So we are working with the regulators, with PwC to actually build this because we think there's going to be a whole 10 to 15 year period or maybe more where we'll run through this hybrid system of trust and trustless. And that's going to be a very interesting thing as we move forward. So we're kind of thinking this whole thing through in terms of how we actually build this entire ecosystem. So these are the seven regulatory sandboxes that we are doing in Singapore. And then just moving on to, before I forget, this is not, I mean, even though we're working with the regulators and the government, these are all industry-led. We are working with about 20 MNCs. We are working with a lot of startups and so on. So this is quite a large piece of work. Now, just jumping on to some of the challenges, because we actually discussed what are the policy challenges. Data and AI, data and AI ethics. So what I would say is data for good and AI for good. This is actually something very close to our heart. While I founded Ocean, with this express mission and vision that we need to make sure that data and AI is in the hands of many, not just a few. Because if we are going to talk about AI changing the life or changing humanity, we cannot give that in the hands of 10 organizations. And that is really scary. So for us, being able to do the right things, and also, you know, Ocean might fail as a company or as a foundation, but the idea needs to remain. So we are actually trying to make sure we actually ingrain these kind of mission values into it. And this is very close to our heart. We are working with Luciano Floridi from Oxford Internet Institute, doing research in areas which we are funding. And then I already mentioned the trust framework. We actually have a 10-year view at the minute, which we'll actually open source everything. Everything we build is going to be open source. There is a huge requirement from citizens and governments that AI is not really a black box. So there's more questions and more demand for transparency, explainability, and provability of whatever is being done. I think there needs to be more work and I think more clarity by policymakers in terms of who really owns the data and how do you really handle consent. I think GDPR was a good move in that direction, but I think there are still massive challenges in that. And then moving on to the next one, governance of decentralized networks. Well, I actually put this very quickly this morning, but I think it's important. There's a lot of trust that's being put on code and on people who actually write that code. Is that good enough? While, you know, today we have those centralized organizations which are somehow managed by government, by regulators, and so on, which is you know, something that's come about through evolution, through a lot of understanding of how really governments and humanity and us as society really work. So what are our responsibilities when we actually have such kind of decentralized networks? Do we just let them become decentralized autonomous organizations? What would that really mean in terms of its responsibility? And who will we blame if something goes wrong? I'll just stop there. This is what Ocean is all about. You know, provide provenance, control over your data assets, ensure auditability, transparency, trust, and security. Thank you.
Brilliant, thank you. And thank you very much for being quick. Appreciate it. So I'd like to open the floor to questions. So we've got 10 minutes left for discussion with the audience. So if there are any questions, please let me know. Maybe the panel speakers could actually come and sit at the front. So first question.
Jan Udy, Georgia Tech. I really enjoyed everyone's presentations. And, of course, I have a lot of questions, but just focusing on the blockchain presentations, I'm wondering, so there's going to be this interim period where there's maybe a lot of solutions, and I'm wondering how you see this unfolding so it won't be yet another burden on the user. Is this going to be yet another one of the hundreds of applications where I have to create yet another password, and or will there be some consolidation benefits for the user?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If I normally have more time to talk, and that's one of the main things I say, we don't want to have another system where, you know, yet another username, password, another system. I think the burden on researchers became already, you know, quite big in the last years with many more platforms. One way in which the blockchain could work is that the users, the researchers, or the editors won't even know, be aware that there's a blockchain in the background. For example, the blockchain for peer review, the onus of storing the data is purely on the side of the shoulders of the publishers. So the only thing that the researchers will know is, oh, hey, the peer review process goes faster, I get more targeted invitations, my recognition information about my process is immediately sent to ORCID, for example. So basically, in that way, the blockchain is basically an underlying infrastructure which again doesn't put any burden on the researcher itself. So it's a very, very important point.
Hello, I'm Linda Hardeman from the Center for Mathematics and Computer Science in the Netherlands. So maybe my question's to Stefan, but you're all welcome to think about it. Data. So we have a lot of data, and if we're going to put that in blockchain, it's going to use all the energy on the planet. So how do we deal with that?
Well, that's a very
That's a very valid argument, and in fact you can't do that, right? You can just organize your data, and then you have to have an off-chain solution for the bigger data solutions. It's just apparently no doubt about that.
If I may add to that, so when we are looking at Ocean, well, actually nothing really stays except for the hash of the data and maybe pointing the data to where, you know, the pointer to where exactly that data sits, and probably the metadata, not even metadata, I would actually say what kind of access controls are allowed. Nothing else sits on chain and should not sit on chain, else you are also breaking GDPR.
Maybe one more thing. Just to take away one misunderstanding, the energy consumption is associated with one way of organizing your blockchain. It's the Bitcoin proof of work. There are other systems like private blockchains or proof of stake that don't have the energy consumption. But no, but there are alternatives for private blockchains. I'll stop now.
So I'm Holger Hoss from the Leiden Institute of Advanced Computer Science. I want to go into exactly the same direction. You know, you say, yeah, proof of stake. As far as I know, this still doesn't work. It's still a pie in the sky. I think it's extremely fascinating research, but to go and say, well, you know, let's have a token system for science, and let's do that globally, because, you know, science is sort of a global undertaking. I wonder whether anybody has seriously thought about the energy implications if we use the proof of work technology that is available right now. I mean, can you even estimate this? I'd love to be convinced that this is not the energy consumption of Argentina, which Bitcoin, I think, has reached this year, a country of 40 million people, right? I think science is probably even bigger, and it's probably even going to be even worse. So can you convince me that that's not the case?
Well, no, yeah. Again, it depends on what kind of blockchain, what kind of solution you're thinking of. Indeed, if you want to have a global system storing everything a researcher ever did on proof of work, it's impossible. But if you want to work with a set of publishers and ORCID and institutions to share something like the peer review metadata, that's a challenge which is way less, but it can already bring great improvements.
You could imagine doing it on a private blockchain, actually.
Yeah, that's probably great.
Yeah, no, thank you. You know everything, and I'm heading the Research Council of Norway, so a middleman and a bureaucrat. I'm also heading the task force of implementation of Plan S, the open access sort of initiative, really pushing for a transition in the business models of publishing in Europe. So I first just wanted to say that we are very committed from the research funding side to utilize new technology, including blockchain, in improving both the quality and the efficiency of the overall research enterprise, including funding, definitely. So we'd be happy to do that. And I would be like to say that we would, as Science Europe, as the umbrella organization of the funding organization, we would be happy to engage with you. Second, the challenge of peer-to-peer on funding is that is a misconception, because really who's on the one side of that sort of transaction? That's the citizen. So it's the citizen to the scientist that is the real transaction you want to sort of mimic. And how then do you realize that transaction? Because it's not scientists who can decide where to fund at all. So, and my last comment is, I'm a bit concerned about tokenization of science, because you can run into in political terms, a very harsh neoliberal market economy in a business that is now more or less run on the ethos of common goods. So, but at the same time, I see the need for incentives, and so how do you reconcile those two extremes, the harsh market and the common good? Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. One of the pieces of work we've been looking at for blockchain is how do we not fund research, but how do we get a better input from the entire citizens of the nation on what they think is actually really important to research. Because currently, actually, to talk about the bottleneck, at least in the UK, we have a bunch of middle managers who basically decide what is correct for the country to be researching, and that may or may not be a good response. Does anyone else have something to say on that?
That's, of course, a very important discussion, and I'm happy to hear your comments on that. When we were invited to this talk, we were allowed to be a bit provocative. say maybe to some extent I have been that. But having said that, I think that blockchain really offers moments of decentralization, and I'm very happy to hear that research councils, I know the Wellcome Trust is doing that, but also the Research Council of Norway, look into this solution. What the outcome then will be, how the efficacy of the science on the peer-to-peer process will be increased, that we do not know. But I think that entering this process is very important, both for the research councils and for the scientists and for society.
Hi, I'm Caroline Pauner from the OECD. And so many thanks for those fascinating examples and cases that you were presenting. And one of the things that always comes up as an advantage of blockchain is the addressing trust and resolving market failures and et cetera. And you've all referred to this in one way or another. But yet in the last, but there are some limitations to what it can do in regarding trust. And in the last presentation, you were referring to hybrid models of where trust needs to be coming from an external source and from an internal one. So I'd be interested in your stake at that on the trust issue.
Yes, so the angle from which we really come to all of this is, what is it that you'll actually put on chain and what you'll put off chain, right? So if you're going to talk about data, let us say you actually are handling some, or you as a data publisher have some data which is quite sensitive, and you're not going to let me download it. But you might actually say, all right, I'm going to let you download it on a trusted third party. Now, who's that trusted third party? How do you actually prove who they are if they have no presence on chain at all? So those kind of scenarios need to be solved. There are things around, we talk to a number of corporates who actually tell us they want to know who exactly is going to use their data, even if the model actually travels to the data and the model never and the data never actually leaves their premises. Now, if they want to know that, then what kind of identity system? Do we have a self-sovereign identity system out there that will actually cater to that? So we do need that hybrid system, and that's why we are actually talking about this trust framework that needs to get you know, to provide that kind of confidence to organizations and individuals that this is actually an ecosystem they can use and it actually can scale. And it's not really a one-off data sharing mechanism, which is what we want to move away from. Else we will never get to this you know, AI and data in the hands of many.
Very shortly, unbreakable. You all said it's unbreakable. I mean, it's a word that we heard so often in the past, and I think that all experience has shown that there is no code that is unbreakable, except Hungarian, possibly. also. And especially with the quantum computers arriving. So are you sure that it is unbreakable forever?
Well, it's still a way away, quantum computing. And just like we also talk, I mean, yes, research, things are moving from research to commercial very, very quickly. And I do buy these arguments also about, you know, whether or not we are moving from proof of work to proof of stake fast enough. Similarly, I would say that we are a few decades away from quantum computing really hitting that. But I think what we are really building is what I would say is dumb networks with actually intelligence on the side, which is what TCP/IP is also all about. So I think innovation will happen, and I think we are not actually suggesting that one kind of blockchain or blockchain will be the successful kind of story. But I think there's still an evolution. It's just been 10 years. That's in short my view.
I think one useful approach, and I think as a lawyer, is to have these sandboxes, like an experiment with different technologies, and, you know, just to be on the safe side of things and see whether they work or not. Because there are a lot of legal and regulatory challenges inherent to these technologies. So, yeah.
So my name is Daniel. I'm here. So from Microsoft. So. I would like to ask you about the difference between the private and the public blockchain. So how do you look at these kind of solutions, for instance, the peer review blockchain? Do you see that the future for the peer review blockchain, is that on the public blockchain, or do you see private blockchains as the solution, and is it Ethereum, or because you get a lot of dependencies on the public blockchains then?
Yeah, so the peer review pilot is typically a case where a private blockchain is sufficient because basically we already have an infrastructure. We have trusted players, we have publishers, we have institutions, we have ORCID, etc. And the goal really is to let them communicate, to let them share data in a safe way. So for that solution, private blockchain is the best fit. It also gives advantages, so the whole the energy consumption of is not a problem that we're facing. Concretely, we're using an application called Ethermint, which is again it's built on Ethereum, but it allows us to have a proof of stake mechanism, which again is much more efficient.
Sorry, I'll just add something. I mean, just because we've also been asked to be a little provocative, I see no point of private blockchains. To me, the difference is between intranet and internet. Only a public network ultimately will win. I can understand in terms of testing out things and so on, but I think ultimately what we'll see is public networks actually winning. There isn't any point of yes for testing for POCs, absolutely. You know,
but how private. Is there privacy on public blockchains?
Well, it's about what you want to put on chain.
Yeah.
That's
and then how you handle the data off chain. Just a rhetoric.
Yeah.
Observation.
Okay, if I may ask a question. I'm Maarten van Steen from the University of Twente, and I've been working on large-scale distributed systems most of my academic life. From day one when blockchain popped up, I had this single question. Can it ever scale? So far, I've not been disappointed because the answer is no. I'm not being cynical. So I really must applaud everyone for seeing all these terrific applications of blockchain. I think it's really fantastic. But the essence is that the core of the blockchain has very, very severe scalability problems. Mm-hmm. Next to privacy and trust, and I see everybody nodding. So if my advice would be is that, you know, maybe we should tone down our voice a bit when it comes to actually exploiting blockchains, because there are really big problems to solve. And my advice would be that if we want to do something with the blockchains, we should start putting more funding in trying to solve the scalability. It may turn out to be actually a showstopper. I'm not quite sure about that yet, but it's just like, okay, private blockchains are a solution. No, they're not, and you know it. So maybe we should stop saying these type of things.
Why not?
It doesn't scale.
Yeah, but again, when you're... Okay,
yeah. Well, but we...
yeah, let's do it.
Okay, let's take that offline. But it's a major concern, and I think it really needs to be addressed a lot more.
So I'm the CEO of a small bio-IT company in Boston with a kind of strong security background. So I'll echo Dominique's point. What would happen to the fundamental trust aspect if we discover 10 years from now that there is a fundamental security hole? Because we all know, and sorry for the guy from Microsoft, but that Windows XP, for example, was sold as the most secure operating system ahead of time. And we are still reeling with the consequences now. So what I'm just trying kind of blue sky, if we close our eyes and think 10 years ahead, what would happen if we discover a fundamental problem with the protocol 10 years from now and we should put all of this stuff on chain, or at least pointing to something that's off chain? Just want to kind of pose that maybe for the coffee discussion.
The question is the chance bigger that that happens than that somebody hacks a bank or hacks the government where confidential information? I think there's always a risk. The question is what risk is lower?
But then you have the bank. Here you don't have anybody. It's decentralized.
I just wanted to say very quickly thank you very much to the speakers. It's been going to be a very fun coffee discussion, I think, by the sound of it. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you. Okay, we have now a coffee break, and of course we have stolen time from it. We have to be back here at 11:30. Please, be back at 11:30.